afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
We're all back. Sorry about the little interruption last week. Got busy at work. Thought you'd enjoy listening to Jim Beers again about wolves. And that topic's coming up again later in the month. There is, I'll post it on the website. I didn't even think about it, but there is a congressional hearing on the, now I'm going to use the term loosely, wolf management practices by federal agencies.
Or lack thereof.
Now, yes. Now, we all know that's not really being managed, but that's what it's called anyway. Had to call it something. So I'll post that. That's on the 21st, and if I remember correctly, that's like 11 o'clock in the morning Pacific time. So that should be fun for everybody. Today, we're chatting with Elaine Willman. You can find all of her information along with, did I do it? Yes, previous shows, I linked them properly, on our webpage at wethepeopleradio.us, and I think you'll like it. So it's 9/11, just, you know, in case you're actually listening today. Always a little strange. We get to the radio station, and there's a Penske truck right out front.
I was afraid to say anything.
It's like, what the heck's with the Penske truck out front? But it's Bob's. It doesn't have fertilizer in it or anything.
I checked it. It wasn't ticking.
Yikes. That was a little weird. It's funny how this particular day, it doesn't matter how many years go by, it's still a little weird and sad. So, anyway, I guess that's
I'm not leaving town, by the way. Just have a load of furniture to move this afternoon.
Just how you do it today, because all the other days are full and busy. No, nothing like a nice little drive to Susanville in your rented truck with furniture in it. All right, so today we're talking about federal Indian policy, and I know we've done this before, so you're thinking, oh, not again. But you know what? I think you're going to like it. Elaine's article is entitled Warpath. Obama's Indian policy threatens all Americans, both tribal and non-tribal citizens. And I think you'll find this information a little bit different spin than things that we've discussed previous. And Elaine, I've got a bunch of information about her. I won't read it all to you. But she's the author of two really super books, Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. That was published back in 2005. And it reports on first-person visits and experience of tribal members and citizens residing on or near 17 Indian reservations during her extensive road trip across the country from Washington State to New York. Her book is actually selling faster. This was from last year. It's actually selling faster in 2015 and 16 than when she initially published it because of the fears expressed in the book are now America's reality. And those of us living in the West know only too well. I don't want to shortcut her second book because it's really, I don't know if I should say it's more important, but I think it's an important book. Slumbering Thunder. It's a primer for confronting the spread of federal Indian policy and tribalism that's overwhelming America. And just in case you think this is going to be We Hate Tribes, her mom and her grandmother were both enrolled Cherokee members, and her husband is Shoshone ancestry and a direct descendant of Sacagawea. So there you go. Everybody
There's some heritage.
Yeah, you can't call us haters exactly. Well, you can call us haters. You just can't call Elaine a hater.
I sent my DNA in the other day. I might be part Indian. I'm going to find
you
out.
You did send it in? That's nice. Nothing like voluntarily giving them your DNA.
Yeah.
Right on, Bill.
Might be somebody just like me out there someday.
It's like last night we went to an NRA
dinner. Turns out he's related to Elizabeth Warren.
One or the other. You can't have both.
He's driven a Cherokee before. Yeah, last night, speaking of giving away information, we were at an NRA dinner, and instead of filling out your little ticket stub for your drawing, they wanted you to give them your driver's license. And then they gave you the drawing tickets.
They swiped the barcode on the back of your driver's license, which seemed a little unnerving.
Everybody was sitting there going, should we give them this? I guess it's the NRA. I guess that's good. Maybe. I don't know. It was weird. So nothing is as it seems. And I think by the time we get done with you today, you'll realize nothing is as it seems. So, hi, Elaine. It's, later afternoon for you?
Good to visit with you again.
Oh, we're doing fantastic. How's the weather out there?
Well, it's a beautiful, beautiful, sunny, big Montana blue sky day out here in the middle of nowhere, Montana, up on the range, so to speak. But I'm in a very somber mood, and perhaps it is September 11th. I'm in this lumbering thunder mood, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So I feel more philosophical than technical today.
Well,
there's lots of things I'd like to talk about.
We read your article again before we came in today, and Bill highlighted most of it.
Well, there's so much of it that's really disturbing. I mean, as far as what our government is electing to give away just because they can, and nobody seems to want to do anything about it.
It is, and you know, we are the prized country on the planet. We truly are. And we who live here are most fortunate. But we're also the bullseye target of a large, you know, tin hat, but it's real, globalization and one world order strategy. And, you know, we're a country that's only 227 years old. Most of our countries on the earth are a lot older than we are.
Oh, sure.
And we're still a country that is, I think, learning by skinning its knees. We do some things really right, and we've done some things really wrong. And I guess where I'm kind of at today is my mind is thinking, where are we going to go from here? And how does this fit with federal Indian policy and the escalation of the power of tribal sovereignty? I kind of think I'd like to talk about, what is this thing called tribal sovereignty today, if that's okay with you guys?
Yeah, we actually called the show is Tribal Sovereignty Constitutional, so we sort of set the stage. We haven't really, we didn't dig into that the last time we spoke with you.
Yeah, it's come about for the classic two reasons. The empowerment of tribal sovereignty has come about from the classic driving forces in our country and most others, and that's power and money. You know, it's really about power and money. But the reality of tribal sovereignty is what Justice Clarence Thomas has called in at least two and maybe more U.S. Supreme Court rulings, one back in 2004 and one just this past summer of 2016 in a case called U.S. v. Bryan. Justice Clarence Thomas challenges his fellow justices and Congress, and he says, show me where is the plenary power of Congress over Indian tribes. Show me where in the Constitution that's there. And he says, you won't find it in the Indian Commerce Clause. Congress has the power over Indian commerce, not Indian tribes. And you won't find it in the Treaties Clause. He said it's not in the Constitution. And so he calls federal Indian policy a fiction, an absolute fiction. That's in his language in that U.S. versus Bryan case. And Justice Scalia shared those views, but we lost him. And there are others that are coming on, other justices that are beginning to see that we have to deal with this. Where I'm coming from is I would just love it if a day could come in our American future where we're Americans, where we're not hyphenated Americans anymore, and we can be respectful of everyone's culture, cultures, and the folks can preserve them, their cultures and traditions because they want to, not because the federal government is demanded to pay for it.
Correct, and elevated them above some others.
Yeah.
Hey, Elaine, we've got to take a really quick break here, and we need to call you back because there's something funky going on your line.
Okay.
It keeps...
It might just be that I have it on speakerphone.
It sounds like you're doing a little electroshock therapy on the side.
Yeah, that speakerphone could be the problem.
I could probably use it.
Yeah,
we weren't going to get into that.
We'll take a quick break, and we'll call you back, Elaine.
And we'll be right back.
Okay.
So you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
They take over, but good. an Indian outlaw. Half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa. Oh, she's a one of a kind. All my friends call me Bear Claw. The village chicken is my pawpaw. He gets his orders from my mama. She makes him walk the line. You can find me in my wigwam. I'll be beating on my tom-tom. Pull out the pipe and smoke you some. And pass it around. Cause I'm an Indian outlaw. Half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa. She's a one of a kind.
I like that song. It's always nice when you come on, Elaine. We can play all those songs.
I know. I love the bumper music. You guys are great with that.
Well, it's got nothing to do with us. We're on the dumb side of the table where you only use your mouth. It's at the other side of the table where all the buttons are that Bob controls.
Elaine, talk to us about when this transformation started. Was it '98 when they started passing these Indian laws or tribal laws?
Oh no!
It was Supreme Court.
The first trigger was back in 1934, when Congress passed the Indian Reorganization Act, and that was an act that John Collier, the BIA commissioner then, who's a communist and avowed communist and author of many communist books, but he ran the BIA, and it was his belief that the American Indians were much better off rather than becoming citizens, which they had been made by Congress in 1934, 10 years earlier. Collier thought it was just better for American Indians to live amongst themselves on Indian reservations and communally rather than to be citizens, property owners, landowners, and fully assimilated as had been the plan for decades before. So that was a triggering point. And the key word here is Indian Reorganization Act. In 34, there were about 70 tribes that the federal government was dealing with across the country. And these tribes were going to be reorganized to live amongst themselves. They were going to stop. It opened up all the reservations to settlers and everybody else. They were going to stop that process and let the tribes recoup what land they could and live amongst themselves. Reorganization for about 70 tribes. We now have 567 tribes, and the bulk of those got their federal recognition not long after 1988. You know why? 1988 was the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, and all of a sudden, these tribes came out of the woodwork and became tribes to get into the Class 3 gaming business, tax-exempt gaming.
Now, is that gaming? Is that
a help from...
Is that Gaming Act, when they get into this, the gaming business, is that subsidized by the federal government?
All of their basic life needs are, their housing, health, law enforcement, courts, education, all of the basic services for the tribal government, for their people, is provided by the taxpayer. So this gaming revenue is free money.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, very much free money, and that has been used to create the power. First, we moved from about 70 tribes to 567 tribes. Then they had all this huge money. In the early years of gaming, it was 20, 30 billion a year. All this huge money that was what I call their free money, and they literally bought high-paid lobbyists that wandered the halls of Congress and their state capitals. They bought legislators, literally, because they're the only governments in the country that can write checks to political parties or candidates.
Yeah, I read that in your article. You mentioned that they're the only entity that can actually write checks directly to political parties and directly to candidates. And nobody else can do that. Boy, that sounds like it gives them a pretty heavy hand in our government.
Yes. That is the political power and the money power that I'm talking about. And there was a 10-year period of time, not long after, just right around, just before the Bush-Gore presidential election, just before 2000, or in May of 2000, had a little three-member federal advisory committee called the Federal Election Commission,
mm-hmm.
the FEC, and a tribe in New York asked the FEC if they could contribute to political parties. And that little three-member advisory commission responded to the Oneidas of New York and said, well, we agree that you are a government for purposes of your governance and federal subsidies, but you are a person for purposes of elections. And that was one little advisory opinion that went out to one little tribe in New York.
And that's never been challenged.
All tribes the same. Pardon?
Never been challenged?
Nope, never been challenged, and we have to treat all tribes the same. And so 567 tribes can take taxpayer money funded for their subsidies or their gaming revenue and send it into PACs or both political parties, both. This is very bipartisan. They cover all bases. Or county commissioners or city council members or state legislators. And that's why I say in the New American article that I wrote that they own Salem, they own Olympia, they own Helena and Boise. They own the state capitals politically. They truly have an inordinate power in our four northwestern states when their population in those states is less than 3% of the population. I think there's 13 million people in the four states.
And that's really...
The American Indians is less than 3% of it.
That's really an amazing closed loop there. I mean, we give them federal and state funds, and then they can turn around and give it right back to the politicians directly,
yeah.
Which it just kind of feeds itself. And why would they ever want to change that?
Well, it doesn't matter if it comes from the federal and state money or if it comes from gaming, because they never get audited, right?
Right. Nobody's looking. Nobody's looking. The Indian Self-Determination Act, I think it was 1975, where the government said, we're going to give you the monies every year, and we're going to let you self-determine how you spend them. And so there's little to absolutely no auditing. Huge dollars that go out to all these tribes.
Wow.
Just imagine 29 federal agencies annually funding 567 tribes. This is all taxpayer dollars going out to the tribes. A very small population, very small enrolled members. And the quality of life is not changing. It's still poverty and lack time on reservations for the tribal families. They're not benefiting from it. But those who have benefited from political contributions are the ones in office, and they're the least likely to change this. So it's a big problem.
Well, then also, too, I noticed you mentioned the 1998 executive order by Clinton to put an Indian agency or Indian office in every single federal agency, and they need to be consulted before those agencies move.
And it's for consultation. And it's only consultation, which is appropriate. And I don't really have a problem with any agency who's going to be doing a project or program on or near an Indian reservation consulting. That seems very, very appropriate. But when you add huge money and political power, and then you add in a little national guilt, you stole the land, we were here first, and then you add in the fact that no elected official likes to be called a racist, they get pretty much everything they want out of our elected officials. They truly do.
Mm-hmm.
They truly do. No tribal government makes federal Indian policy. They benefit from it, but they don't make the decisions. Our state legislators, our Senate and House, or the courts, or the executive branch, are American leaders federal Indian policy. That the consultation with tribes gives them their direction. And the direction going on right now is a horrific expansion of tribal jurisdiction replacing state jurisdiction, of tribal governance over non-tribal persons and properties, where none of that is allowed in their tribal constitutions, but the feds are delegating their jurisdiction and states are delegating their jurisdiction to tribes so that tribes can govern you and me. We can't go to the feds, we can't elect their officials. But this transfer of physical jurisdictional authority to tribal governments is really taking over the four northwestern states.
Yeah, that's the really that's disturbing
the
part.
Yeah, I was going to say most of the western states. We need to take another really quick break here, and we're going to try something different with the phone because it's still. Can you hear that?
Yeah, I can hear a little ticking every now and then, but the weather is very clear here, and my phone's in very good shape.
I talked to you yesterday for like 2 hours. And
I know.
There was like no bad sounds whatsoever.
Yeah.
Hang on the line, and we'll have.
I'll try something else. I had it on a charger, so I just took the charger off. So,
it's still doing it.
Not helping.
Huh. Isn't that bizarre?
Did you say you were on a speakerphone, Elaine?
No.
She took that off.
No.
Took that off? Pretty soon she's going to have to stand with, on one, like you do at, we do up at your mom's house. You know, you got to stand on one foot with your hand out the window and blinking your eyes rapidly. It's terrible.
She could always send smoke signals.
Bob said you could always send us smoke signals.
We'll translate them on the same.
We have fires everywhere. Forget the smoke signals. Hang on the line, and you and Bob can chat about the connection, and the rest of us will listen to some nice commercials. Okay. We'll be right back with you.
Land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you, please, don't fence me in.
Surely I'll be there to shake your hand. Surely I'll be there to share the land that they'll be giving away when we all live together. I'm talking about together now. Maybe I'll be there to shake your hand. Surely I'll be there to share the land that they'll be giving away. We all live together. I'm talking about together now.
And we're back. You're listening to We the People. We're here with Elaine Willman, chatting about federal Indian policy. And I hope you'll go to the website and read the entire article from the New American that she just put out at the end of August. You can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, how's our connection, Elaine? Is it better?
Well, I think it's... We made another effort. I just phoned in.
Oh yeah, it sounds
better.
Sounds a lot better. Hey, one of the things I was reading in your article here, we were talking about how much money the federal government gives the tribes, and you mentioned here that the cumulative annual dollars are likely equivalent to the annual federal defense budget. That gives you kind of an idea how much money we're talking about here.
And it has never, ever been audited.
Yeah, that's amazing. Because
that
is a ton of money.
We asked the top dog at the Bureau of Indian Affairs back in around 2006, I think it was, George Scabeen. He was the go-to guy at the BIA for at least 30 years. And he was a keynote speaker at a conference I attended. He was asked if the federal government had ever audited how many annual dollars go out to the tribes from the various agencies. And he said, well, we tried that once, but we just couldn't do it. And the follow-up question was, don't you think you should? And his response was, well, I don't think it's necessary.
Oh, absolutely
not. But
if you do the math,
567 times 29 federal agencies, and they all get many multi-millions every year. That's a lot of money since 1934, actually since 1855. Our American Indians are the only ethnicity that has received annual federal resources every single year. And those resources are off the charts now.
Why do you suppose they're not required to audit?
Because of their sovereignty. Federal government's supposed to leave them alone.
Once we give them the money, that's theirs. They can do what they want.
Yeah,
we don't look back.
They have self-governance. So it's like, just give us the money, we'll do with it what we want.
So we siphon it off the working people.
They siphon it off their own members more than anything else.
Then there's that.
The gaming money, the purpose of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was for economic development to improve the quality of life on Indian reservations for the tribal members. Now, that's not happening. It's just not happening.
Well, you'd think it'd happen just with the money that we give them. I mean, if it's that much money, you'd think that would be enough to make life a little easier for them. I mean, you know, even though there are 567 tribes, you'd think that that money would spread out and give a pretty good hand up.
And there are legitimate tribal, there are legitimate Indian tribes, and then there are those, and California is a classic example of over, I don't know how many casinos they have in California, but all of a sudden California just burst forth with federally recognized tribes with an enrollment of maybe 3 people, 5 people, 20 people.
Yeah, we've got a casino on every corner.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Is there a requirement to how many people, you know, can constitute a federally recognized tribe?
Yeah, what's the requirements to become a recognized tribe?
Well, none of the tribes are huge populations. I mean, we have 324 million Americans today in the country. And for those who mark the census box as Native Americans, that's maybe 2 million. And of those, most of them aren't enrolled. There's maybe a little over 1 million that are actually enrolled in a tribal government. So we're talking a little over 1 million American people that are tribally enrolled in a tribal government, one of 567. So these are not large populations. And I don't think most listeners understand that Indian reservations were long ago opened up, and they're predominantly non-Indian. And in the California area, my favorite story is we've helped for years, some folks in Amador County, where there's a tribal, the American gaming industry really pushes this. We thought originally that they would be adversarial to tax-exempt Indian gaming. No, they saw a gold mine. And so rather than Las Vegas and Tahoe and Atlantic City, we now have what I call McDonald's for the mob. You have India, you have tribal casinos all across the country. And so the American gaming industry goes for it. They will go to the tribal and say, we'll help you get federally recognized. We'll pay for that. We'll help you get federally recognized. We will plan and build and pay for your casino, and we will train your employees. And we'll just take a 7-year management contract from you. And boom, 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 California just burst forth with Class 3 casinos of tribes of very small numbers.
Well, there's no incentive for the politicians to not do that if they know on the backside they're going to end up reaping a lot of the rewards from that.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the money wheel. And to me, the tragedy is giving a really tarnished image of wonderful tribal families and Indian people. I mean, there was a time when I was growing up, there was a time when there was a genuine respect for the American Indians and for our history, and, you know, regardless of the mutual pain we all went through, there was a genuine respect. But with what's going on in California and in other places, now we have these what we call casino Indians. And some of those with a very small membership are getting something like $30,000 a month from gaming. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But most of the tribal governments and the tribal families are getting zip. Zip.
And there's no, they decide within their own organization how the money is divvied up?
Not exactly either. The tribal constitutions, that when they are federally chartered as an Indian tribe, their tribal constitution do not recognize the U.S. Constitution. So when they elect leaders, and very often these leaders are families or what they call clans, the leaders will swap chairs, but the leadership usually stays the same over time. A tribal member that disagrees or tries to change reality on the reservation can face very serious repercussions. They don't have the Bill of Rights. They're full U.S. citizens off the reservation, but under their tribal government, they do not have the Bill of Rights. There is an Indian Civil Rights Congress that was doing a wonderful thing when it passed the Indian Civil Rights Act. And, aren't we good? Now we've helped our tribal families. But they put no enforcement mechanism in that Indian Civil Rights Act, so it's toilet paper, you know. And so the tribal members get retaliation if they disagree with whatever their government is doing. And here, on this flathead, I've lived on 3 reservations, and all 3. I've worked with I have a lot of tribal family friends, and I've worked with those who have experienced that retribution severely, really severely. There's a couple here in Montana that disagree. They stood up and they did not want their tribal government getting a major hydropower dam. And they were very courageous because their tribe, they just didn't think their tribe could handle it. They're very courageous to stand up and say so. And then they got a knock on the door from the Tribal Child Protective Services telling them, you're bad parents, and they haven't seen three of their girls in 19 months. You know?
Wow.
That was for standard. So the rest of them, they can lose housing, they've lost jobs, they lose children. You don't sit with, we speak, I speak, and I mean this sincerely. I speak for the tribal members that contact me or some of my colleagues. When they reach out quietly and tell us what's happening and they need help, there's very little help we can offer them, but I can sure the heck speak for them and talk about the reality of life under a tribal government. It's, with a rare exception, it's really tough. It's a hard row.
Elaine, how does it work? You mentioned them owning a utility. How does that work if they're not required to abide by public safety and what is it, the Homeland Security Acts? How does that work? How could they actually, I mean, they could run a dam, they could run, if something goes wrong, it's they're not responsible.
Something's already gone wrong up here. They own the former Kerr Dam, major hydropower dam that's called the Black Start Dam, meaning if that dam, if all the dams in the Northwest were to collapse or go, be out of commission, this dam is deep enough it can restart itself and power up the other dams.
Oh.
And this little tribal government owns it now, or manages it now. It's in trust for the tribe. This is one of Obama's new deals. The previous administrations, Bush and Clinton and Bush Sr., the previous administrations have been very, very generous with tribal governments, but Obama has just knocked himself out. In 2010, he decided that America's power grid, you know, this is for all 324 million of us, America's national power and energy grid would be really good economic development for tribal governments. And so billions, literally billions with a B, have gone out in training programs. They're pushing, the administration is pushing tribal governments to go acquire dams and electric facilities and the energy grid. Now, isn't that cute? Because they don't answer to our Constitution. They don't have a duty to non-enrolled people. And they're it's just polka dotting the country with placing our major energy grid at some, you know, some risk.
Well, sure. If they're not required to follow safety, national safety standards, national homeland security standards, how in the heck could they be involved with something as important as our power grid?
Exactly. Well, because this president thinks it's just great economic development for Indian tribes. It's that simple and that ugly.
Boy, that is.
It really is.
That does not sound good to me. I don't know.
No, it is not, you know. So, and then it gets a little worse if we look back in history and realize that when the West was being settled and these dams were going in and power services were going into the Western states, a Secretary of Interior, A.B. Fall, required that all these power and water facilities be located on or near Indian reservations over 100 years ago. So when you look at Hoover Dam or Grand Coulee Dam or any of the big dams in the country, you will find they are within an Indian boundary or right next to them. Now, that allows the federal government to keep a foothold on the water and power in the West. And see, what's going on now is we've always heard about this revisionist history.
Yep.
What's going on now is history is getting reversed, intentionally reversed.
Mm-hmm.
By the executive branch, and with the sanctions, the cooperation of the Senate and Congress. I mean, the Senate and Congress passed the Indian Energy Policy Act. They had to agree to it, and they did. And that goes back to that power and money.
And when did that happen?
2010.
Indian
Energy Policy Act, yeah. Yeah. Now, the newest game, and they're playing a very serious hide the ball as we speak. The newest game is they're just passing a big omnibus Indian energy appropriation bill for this whole thing. Another one. And some of my colleagues and I located literally dozens of forest management act revisions. And within these bills in front of Congress right now, these dozens of them, is the plan to transfer the management of our national forests to tribal governments if their reservation is within 100 miles of a national forest. And they're thinking that that is a good solution to the management of our forests. Now, the wicked thing about that is that the guys doing it, one is a congressman in Arkansas. His bill is moving rather quickly. There's maybe one or two small national forests in Arkansas and one or two tribes. So it has little impact on his constituents. And then there's a senator, Westerman, in Kansas, on the Senate bill. And again, one or two small national forests in Kansas and maybe one or two tribes. Very little impact. But look at Washington. Look at all the rest of the western states.
Oh, yeah.
And where the national forests are and where most of the tribal governments are. And so when we started screaming about those bills, they played hide the ball. They've now eliminated and shuffled around and tucked the Forestry Management Act into the middle of this Indian Energy Policy Act and appropriation bill, and we just discovered it, and we're trying to stop it. Again, the forest has two things besides timber and the public recreation that we all need to be able to participate in. It's also the very headwaters, the snowpack. It's the headwaters of America's waters. And so where we've already got these huge water settlement acts where the tribes are getting control of all the rivers and tributaries and whatnot, getting management of our forests gives them all the waters, beginning with the first snowflake up on top of a mountain. And it gives them the ability to say, well, okay, you can come in and visit the forest. You can walk this trail, but you can't. Well, we're closing this off because they have no duty to anyone but their enrolled tribal members.
So they're transferring
this is horrific.
They're transferring the management, but not the ownership.
No, they'll keep it in trust. The United States will keep it in trust. The United States will continue to own the land, but the tribal government will have the jurisdiction and the management of the land.
So we'll continue to pay for it, and then they can tell us whether or not we can use it or not. That's beautiful.
Right.
Yeah.
See, and it's funny because it depends on where you are in the country, but some tribes actually log and do those kinds of things, and they have far less restriction than the rest of us do, which is crazy on the face of it.
Yes, you're right, Aaron. Some tribes do forest management extremely well.
We have the guys up north of us who we better take a quick break before I launch into that tirade.
Okay.
We'll be right back. We're here with Elaine Willman. We're talking about federal Indian policy. And for those of you that are a little behind the curve on that and you wonder what the heck is going on, she's got two fantastic books that we would definitely recommend. And at the very least, tune into some of the shows we've done with her and read the articles. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up. walk away and know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
There's no way they got enough time to count all that money.
Well, then why would you? You're not being audited.
That's right.
Hey, Elaine, in your article, there's one part that we kind of, I don't know if we skipped over it, we just kind of went around it, but you said here, politics and perception have created the perilous false reality that tribal sovereignty is superior to the sovereignty of states.
Yes. Yes, and thank you for reminding me of that, Aaron, because that is the political perception, and I think that that is kind of the American public's perception, that tribal sovereignty is superior to all other sovereignty. But within our Constitution, this is where Justice Clarence Thomas is coming from, there's only three sovereignties, and they're in order. They're in priority. The first sovereignty is yours and mine as a citizen. It's the popular sovereignty. That's the priority. That's why we have the Bill of Rights and the Ten Amendments. That's the citizens. The second sovereignty is the states. We have to remember it was the 13 states that created the federal government. So their sovereignty is second. The third sovereignty is the sovereignty of the federal government that was created by the states. There is no other sovereignty within the U.S. Constitution. And that's why Justice Thomas says, where is it? Where is your plenary power? Where is this tribal sovereignty in the U.S. Constitution? It is not there. But this has been such a propaganda machine that really escalated when the money came in from Indian gaming and stuff like that, that folks just assume that tribal sovereignty is superior. And again, a lot of that is that, you know, we're a generous heart. American public is a generous heart. We take on false guilt quite easily. I mean, they were here first. Oh, my God, we should do penance forever. That kind of a thing. It's very, very psychologically and politically persuasive. And so we all think, oh, well, we have to help the poor Indians. And all these high-paid lobbyists just barrage the halls of Congress and go in and wring their hands and say, my people, my people, and they get more. And it's just a vicious circle. So the other problem is our state governments, and it started with Washington State, with old Governor Jim Lowry. The states have no fiduciary duty or trust relationship with tribes. That's only the federal government, unless a state self-imposes one, which is what Governor Lowry did in 1989, 1 year after the Gaming Act, for Washington State. And that's the governors here in Montana have self-imposed a trust relationship with the tribes here in Montana. I would bet money the same thing's true in Oregon. I don't think Idaho has. But most of our states have self-imposed a trust relationship with these tribal governments. So we now have double dipping. Montana spends millions of state taxpayer dollars and rolls it out to these seven little tribes. Montana has an Indian office in every state agency, as does Washington, and I'll bet money, as does Oregon. And so here you have this federal, you know, money machine, and now you have state money machines rolling dollars out to these tribal governments because, of course, tribal sovereignty is so important. Our citizen sovereignty, getting our property rights wiped out, and our state sovereignty, they're sacrificing their own state sovereignty, but there's some good news on this that we're coming across. And one is a state official, not a governor, not a county commissioner, not the attorney general, a state official may not violate or erode the state's authority under the 10th Amendment. That 10th Amendment, it linchpins the state's sovereign authority under the Constitution to keep a balance between state governments and the federal government. So where all these fools in the states, and I'm just speaking of the governors of these states who have condoned this and benefited from this, they have all said, we're gonna set up a trust relationship and start doling out taxpayer dollars, state dollars, to these tribes to and it's really not legal. And we're going to, you know, the group up here is going to be filing a very big case because of this water compact thing here that we're fighting with.
Well, it becomes, it just becomes kind of, I mean, it's unworkable in the long run. Sorry, add the one more,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, it is. Well, no, you're absolutely right, it's unworkable, but what it's doing is it's escalating the spread of tribal jurisdiction over our forests, our lands, our waters, our energy, and it's all with the blessings of these states and the Congress. And I don't know, and it's hard to change because that's that money wheel. The money comes right back in to the decision makers that are making these decisions. So our elected officials, by and large, here in Montana, I'll just use Montana, they're now serving 6% of the population, and the rest of us are just sucking soup. So,
jeez Louise, we're going to come back and finish this whole topic here. We probably won't finish it, but we're going to talk about it some more in the next hour. You are joining We the People Radio. We're here with Elaine Willman. Catch us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Yes, the Electric Indian today.
Welcome back. You're joining the second hour of We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. And I guess if you joined us halfway through here, I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Bob does all our fun music. Bill and I just, you know, chatterbox. That's our job, to chatterbox. And our chatterboxing today is with Elaine Willman. She is the author of two terrific books that I think you ought to read. And let me make sure I get all the, whoops, I wasn't on the right spot on my webpage.
Elaine is our go-to Native American.
She is. She's got all of this federal Indian policy right at the tip of her fingers. Her first book is Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. Second book that just came out is Slumbering Thunder, a primer for confronting the spread of federal Indian policy and tribalism overwhelming America. And so if you don't live in the West and you don't deal with this stuff all the time, you might be thinking, what are these people all hysterical about? But I'll tell you, I attended a secret meeting. I found out about the secret on, I think it was Monday night, and the meeting was Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock up in Wairika. And you had 50 people at this secret meeting. The guy from the Bureau of Reclamation, top guy actually, told me that it wasn't a secret meeting. It was an informal meeting. Except he had to buy a plane ticket to get there, and so did at least three other people in the room. I explained to him that informal meetings are where you run into someone in the grocery store and then you go have coffee. You don't buy plane tickets to informal meetings because that makes it a formal meeting. And how did 50 people find out about this informal meeting? Four tribes, a whole bunch of federal agencies, a bunch of environmental nonprofits, and it just so happened the only people who didn't get invited were the local congressional office and the board of supervisors for the county that was being impacted by the stuff they're talking about.
That's so, what's known as a congressional oversight.
It was a representative oversight. I mean, all the people who represented the people that were going to be affected were left off the list again. I mean, it's not the first time that.
Well, it was just this an just, oversight.
This just goes on and on and on.
It was a big list to send out, and obviously people are going to get, you know,
obviously.
And, they'll do better next time.
And we were really casual about it. Here are our cards in case you've lost our contact information again. But it's crazy. So here these four tribes sat there, and at one point they were talking about making an agreement. They're working on an agreement about some of the different rivers and the watershed, blah, 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 along the Klamath. And the one river they were discussing has no available water. All of that water has been adjudicated. So it's owned by other people. So I couldn't, and I asked them, I said, how are you going to make an agreement about a river that has no available water for you? You're going to steal it? And you know, everybody gets all itchy, you know, when you say stuff like that, which is obviously why I keep saying it. But it's true. Are they planning on stealing it? And I think they are, actually, if they can get away with it. One of the members from one of the tribes said, well, we don't understand why those people's water rights count at all. We don't consider them valid. We should be the ones controlling all the water, and we should be telling those farmers and ranchers how to manage their property up there. Oh. So, I mean, the federal government isn't the only one that's gone crazy. You know, I mean, Elaine, these tribes are obviously hook, line, and sinker, and they think that they are the boss of everyone.
Well, you're speaking of exactly what has occurred here with this horrible Water Settlement Act that we're trying to stop Congress from ratifying. When the reservations were opened and the allotment came out and Indians were given allotted parcels and became landowners themselves, with every Indian allotted parcel, there was an attached water right. And the same thing when the Homesteaders Act came on and the non-Indians moved into the reservations and had homesteaded parcels. Those parcels, those patents, also had an attached water right to their patent. So the allotted lands had a patent with guaranteed water rights to that landowner and the homesteaded parcels, and that's probably the situation down there, too. So here in Montana, with this Water Settlement Act, those patents have been removed. Those water rights have been literally stolen, removed from those patents, and they're being transitioned into what we call tribal water allocations. Now, the tribe will tell those farmers and landowners how much water they can have. They've literally been stolen with the help of the state. I mean, absolutely with the help and the blessing of the state of Montana. Montana, the head of their DNRC, just a year or so ago, you know, concurrent with the work going on this water settlement, our state Department of Natural Resources sent 100 of their staff down to the tribal headquarters here on the Flathead for a 2-day training on how the tribe wants the water managed. 100 of our state DNRC officials transported down to the headquarters of the Salish Kootenai to work out how they're going to do all this theft of Montana's waters and these private property rights, water rights that have been stolen. It's that serious. That's how serious it is. We have an attorney general here, Tim Fox. I'm sure he won't mind me bragging about his recent accomplishment, because he bragged about it. It was all over the front page of the Missoulian big ceremonial full-color pictures. You know, he was just recently adopted into the Crow Tribe as an honorary Crow Tribal member, our Montana Attorney General. And so his new name is Chief Spirit Runner. And he in the big article announcing his adoption into the Crow Tribe, he's bragging about, now he's running for re-election this year, but when he was first elected, within the first 2 weeks as Montana's Attorney General, he took 50 of his state employees to this tribal headquarters to be sure that his state employees understood the relationship between the state of Montana and this tribe and the cultural significance and the importance. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
This state is slitting its own wrists as a state by just throwing everything, including jurisdiction and authority over state waters and theft of private property water rights, to the tribes. And it's illegal. It will ultimately be defeated. But it's going to take years through the courts to do that, and look at the damage that's going to occur before then. You know what I mean? So it's a very heavy issue, and we have, not only do the tribal governments collectively have some supreme power, but they have good friends, the environmentalists, the Agenda 21 folks. Within federal Indian policy regulations now, all the language of Agenda 21 is being put in there. If you look at the map of Agenda 2030 for the North American continent, there are no states on that map. It's regional,
right?
Nations regional.
And what is it? Six region? What are we? Six regions or seven?
I think it's ten.
Was it that big?
I could be wrong.
I just remember it was pretty small. I mean, it was a lot less than 50 states, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, the 50 states are gone, and it's now a United Nations regions within what used to be the United States. And amazingly, you know, I mean, just a few years ago for me, I thought all this stuff is just goofy. But the United Nations Indigenous Peoples Movement, the Agenda 2030, the collective power of the tribes in this country that want to be separate sovereigns under the United Nations, but the feds, we still have to keep funding them, of course. All of these partners are huge. These globalist partners are backing the play, and really, literally, these tribal governments are being used as pawns to facilitate the destruction of the country. And you can thank President Obama for lighting a big match to this.
Well, you start looking at, I mean, like just the meeting that I described for you before the break. You know, you have nobody from county government, so all the citizens of the county are not represented. You have no one there from the congressional office, so all of the people represented there, you know, same folks, but, you know.
All the federal lands.
You know, you've got none of that. But the Forest Service, that was how we found out what was really supposed to happen at that meeting, mm-hmm. because obviously when we showed up, it became a meeting where they talked about nothing. And did you watch Idiocracy yet?
Yeah, I walked into some of those where suddenly nothing's happening.
Yeah, suddenly nothing's happening. And, we'll play you. You know what? After one of these breaks, mm-hmm. I'll play you the clip from the movie Idiocracy where they talk about where they talk about Brondo, because honest to God, that's what these meetings are like. They're crazy. And so here you've got 50 people, some of whom have flown across the country, and they talk about nothing because they really don't want the federal and county. And I suppose if anybody was there from the Assembly or the State Senate, they don't want them to know what they're up to. So,
I thought it was interesting. They had video presentation all geared up and ready to go. And then as soon as the meeting started, all the equipment quit working. And they couldn't show
it. No, they just didn't show it, which was funny. But the first secret meeting I went to about the Klamath Dams earlier this year, they started the slide presentation, and then a slide came up where it said they were creating a private entity. It was basically a shell corporation to manage the Klamath Dams in order to circumvent Congress. That's what the slide said, at which point, you know, Mr. Sheets threw himself on the projector and said that the slideshow was broken, which was classic.
In the program.
It was just funny. But we made a mental note. Next secret meeting, we need to show up late so they get, you know, they get into the swing of things. But honestly, you've got all these people who do not have the interest of the citizens or the private property rights of the citizens, and they're talking about how they're going to divvy up their stuff.
Their private property.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to tell them how to live their life on their land. Yeah. It's like, wow. And that's the deal. Yeah. I mean, that's what the agencies are up to, and they're totally using the tribes to make it happen.
Yep. And as the tribes get that jurisdiction, your property rights are gone. Your civil rights are gone. Your constitutional protections under the state or federal constitution are gone. They're just gone when the jurisdiction becomes tribal. And the only remedy is through the courts. The Supreme Court is fixing a lot of this. We have powerful new rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court. But we can't get a governor or, we can't get county commissioners. We can't get anybody to pick up these rules and fight back.
Because this fits right into their, you know, I mean, we've got Moonbeam Brown here in California. You've got Bisexual Brown up in Oregon.
Yeah,
those governors are just thrilled, you know. Woohoo, we get to steal everything from all the private citizens. This is fabulous. And then we're going to make utopia, you know. We've got to take a really quick break. And that part went away kind of fast. We'll be right back. We are chatting with Elaine Willman about federal tribal policy and how that's affecting you, whether you think it is or not. It is. It's coming for you. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Indians dressing up like cowboys, and the cowboys are putting leather and turquoise on, and the music is sold by lawyers, and the fools who fiddle in the middle of the station are gone. Some folks say at the old locomotive made. So when you smell smoke and cinder, just slip back your head, open up your case. Play a Cherokee fiddle, just play it for the whiskey. Good whiskey never lets you lose your place.
You know, that's one thing the Cherokees and the Irish have in common.
Oh, they're fiddle players.
Oh, I was thinking about the whiskey.
Oh, well.
The Welsh.
There you go,
leave
I'm not
the,
Irish.
Leave it to the Welsh to lose focus.
Yeah. Going for the music.
Oh, my gosh. Elaine. So, I had Bob queued up the thing here for Brando. For those of you who don't know this movie, it's really a dumb movie. You can find it on Netflix. I think you can watch it online too. It's called Idiocracy, and I think it's from 2006, if I remember right. The guy that wrote it, it was just a spoof, kind of a, I don't know, not really science fiction, I guess, but it was like look into the future, and if everybody was dumber in the future than they are now, how would things be? Well, you know, I think we're going there. And he said he never actually thought it was going to be a prophecy. He thought it was just a spoof. So here's just like a little clip out of it. This Brando stuff is like a sports drink. And anyway, they have a meeting about it. And these are the meetings that we all get to go to. For those of you that are missing all these little meetings with the agencies and stuff as they talk about how nothing. They're going to take away your land rights.
And logic.
This is the logic that is used. Take it away, Bob.
What the hell is this? Tastes like Gatorade.
Is that Brando stuff?
They're watering crops with a sports drink?
Brondo the Thirst Mutilator had come to replace water virtually everywhere. Water, the basic component of all life, had been deemed a threat to Brondo's profit margin. The solution came during the budget crisis of 2330, when the Brondo Corporation simply bought the FDA and the FCC, enabling them to say, do, and sell anything they wanted.
That's Brando, the world being relabeled Joe with Brando.
Didn't know any of this, but he did see a problem that he might actually be able to solve. With his options running out, Joe took a bold step. He would not get out of the way. This time, he would lead.
For the last time, I'm pretty sure what's killing the crops is this Brando stuff.
But Brando's got what plants crave. It's got electrolytes.
So wait a minute. What you're saying is that you want us to put water on the crops?
Yes.
Water. Like out the toilet?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be out of the toilet, but yeah, that's the idea.
But Brondo's got what plants crave.
It's got electrolytes.
Okay, look. The plants aren't growing, so I'm pretty sure that the Brondo's not working. Now, I'm no botanist, but I do know that if you put water on plants, they grow.
Well, I've never seen no plants grow out of no toilet.
Hey, that's good. You sure you ain't the smartest guy in the world?
Yeah.
Okay, look, you want to solve this problem. I want to get my pardon, so why don't we just try it, okay? And not worry about what plants crave.
Brando's got what plants crave.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
What are electrolytes? Do you even know?
It's what they use to make Brando.
Yeah, but why do they use them to make Brando?
Because Brando's got electrolytes.
After several hours.
There you go. You've now been to every meeting I've ever attended.
Round and round and round.
It's not pretty, but unfortunately it's true. So, Elaine, have you been to those meetings too?
Yes, but, you know, I think we might have a bad connection again. Am I coming through?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. We can hear you fine.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, you mentioned that. I'm going to get that Goofy movie in.
It's hard to watch. It really is. I mean, it's really stupid. But
yeah.
When you look at
Luke Wilson in it, Maya Rudolph.
Well, I'll tell you what, funny. It's a lot like real life right now. I mean, we're doing things that are crazy. Yes. You know,
it is, and it goes right along with the dumbing down.
Oh, absolutely,
amazingly dumbed down.
Well, the guys from the Native American guys that have been here for a long time and the settlers that were here a long time, have been here a long time, people in their 80s, they all say, gosh, you know, before the dams, the Klamath River ran dry in the summer and all the fish died. We used to have to pile up the fish and burn them because they made the town smell so bad. But their, their kids and their children's children, their grandchildren, are running these tribes now. And they're telling everybody if we take the dams out, they'll have more water and more fish.
Yeah,
I mean it's crazy. It's not even circular logic because it's not even connected.
Speaking of logic, something that has troubled me is looking at the logic of all this. First, if you just look at our national population and every human being that lives in our country has certain needs, certainly water and power. That's what creates life on in businesses or farms or wherever. And so when this water and power is all shifting away to a government that has no duty to, that's a problem. But there's a sort of a philosophical thing that really, or logic thing that really troubles me. And one is that we probably have thousands of ethnicities, cultures on the planet Earth. But there's one ethnicity on the whole planet Earth that honors Mother Earth, and that's the Native Americans. They're the only ones that honor Mother Earth. And that is a mantra that is rolled out and that people always just accept. You know, that no other, certainly not farmers or ranchers or any other ethnicity honors Mother Earth like the American Indian. And all the cultures on the planet, they're the only ones. There's a problem with logic on that to me. And another thing that really troubles me, and I watched this happen up in Idaho or northern Idaho, is that of all these thousands of cultures in our country and other countries, only the bones, the remains of the Native Americans are sacred. No other bones are sacred. Only the bones of Native Americans. These are the kinds of very illogical
That's true.
Premises, very illogical premises upon which this shame and guilt and we were here first. Just, when I hear we were here first, during the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, when countries were out conquering each other, I say, well, if you were here first, you're very fortunate we were here second, because we didn't, the pilgrims that came in, it took them 40 years to survive and settle Jamestown, and they didn't come here to conquer anybody. But it's as though, all right, you were here first, we were here second, and it's a darn good thing for you because we didn't decimate you like conquerors were doing then. We're not studying you like the dinosaurs, as we would had any other conqueror come on this continent and planted a flag. You know what I mean?
Well, that's true.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, yeah. But we take a whooping because they were here first. Well, when from 1789 forward, when the United States government was created, we're equal. We have the 14th equal protection. We're all equal Americans. And so what the heck does first matter? How about the child born this morning? Is he not equal to the American Indian? It's that kind of illogic that is just foundational on this hoax. It really is. And troubles me deeply, but, you know, I don't mean to be such a bummer or a downer, Debbie Downer here, but there is some good news coming that I'd also like to talk about.
Nice.
Oh.
Yes.
So one of the things that has been slowly, it's taken a lot of research and a lot of the studies of legal cases, and but now it's putting right under our nose. I want to talk about the Territorial War Powers Act for just a moment, because that was the War Powers Act that came up after the Civil War, during the Reconstruction era, when the country was trying to come back together after the Civil War. And it was used, the Territorial War Powers was put in place so that marshals could go on to plantations in the South and rescue slaves that had not been freed by their plantation owners, bring them up north, and free them. They set up the Freedmen's Bureau, Territorial War Powers, freed the slaves, brought them up north. But we were also settling the West then. And so the Freedmen's Bureau became the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the Territorial War Powers Act was used in all the territories, Louisiana Purchase, Northwestern, all the territories. That was the governing authority that gave the federal government the right to execute treaties with the Indians and to essentially settle the West and create states. Once a state was created and had its statehood, the Federal War Powers Act was null and void, could never be used against the state. It was three separate, second priority sovereign in the Constitution. Federal War Powers Act cannot touch the state. It's only effective and legal in territories.
Hmm.
Now, a really interesting little thing. In our water compact settlement agreement, where the state has handed off all these waters in 11 western counties to this little tribe, on page 2 of this big set of water compact, there's a sentence in there that says the Secretary's authority is under section, is authorized to take these actions under 43 U.S.C. section 1457. 43 U.S.C. section 1457. That is the Territorial War Powers Act. That is the authority, that is the underlying federal authority being used to take the state's waters and give them to the tribe. And it's not legal. It's absolutely not legal. Another little example. The tribes, the gaming tribes especially, the tribes that are acquiring land on the open market, they certainly have that right to acquire land on the open market. But when they take that land and they ask the Bureau of Indian Affairs to place it into federal trust, the authority, without the approval of the state legislature, the authority for fee to trust, taking state property out of a state's tax base and putting it in a title to the United States on trust for the Indians, that authority is the Territorial War Powers Act, and it's not legal. So the good news coming is that our courts are now, we have cases in New York, in California, ours coming from Montana is coming soon. There will be cases, and the United States Supreme Court is aware of this now. And again, I go back to Justice Clarence Thomas saying, where's your authority? There is no authority under the U.S. Constitution. There is no authority under the War Powers Act against states. And so I can actually hope in my lifetime that this horrible hoax on American taxpayers and this destruction of state authorities and protections and states that are willingly giving away their authority and their resources, I can see the end of this. I can actually see the light at the end of this tunnel now because of that foundational territorial war powers, which is being used to spread this tribalism as a governing system across the country.
Wow.
It took a lot of digging, a lot of trouble to find it, but it's coming soon. And, you know, a lot of these Indian attorneys and legal counsel, they're very worried about it. This has been a really lucrative lifestyle for decades.
Yeah, they should worry, huh?
Yeah, yeah. The problem is the states, our state governors, most of the state governors, and Congress won't fix this, but the courts will and can. And I think it's coming sooner than I had initially hoped.
Wouldn't that be a weird twist? The courts finally step in and do a course correction, send us the right direction. We need to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with Elaine Willman in just a second. And wrap up the hour with her. You can find all the good information about the show and when we're on and how to sponsor us and archives and all that jazz. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I wouldn't have no boss, but I'd be raising my lonely dental floss.
Raising my lonely dental floss.
Who is this?
That is Frank Zappa.
Oh, of course.
I wonder if he's my neighbor. I might be moving to Montana.
To raise some dental floss.
Your music, man, is just the best. Just the best.
That's better than here. They're all moving here to raise pot, so. Move to Montana. Dental floss doesn't smell. And there's no black market.
That's
okay,
wonderful.
So back to business.
Yeah. So we're a country 227 years old. I have a great grandchild who's 1 year old, and I really have a. This is moving so fast because of the triumvirate of the globalists, the United Nations, the Agenda 21, the One World Order people. All of whom are supporting and facilitating this spread and the like-minded goals of the tribal governments. I worry that when my great-grandchild is 21 years old, he may not even live in the United States. He really may not. If our citizens don't start stand up and raising hell, and our states don't start behaving as states, as the second powerful sovereignty in our Constitution, we're really at risk of being one of those marvelous countries with a unique republic form of government that is the prize on the planet and the primary target of these globalists. We may not have the United States in 21, 25 years or sooner.
No, it's definitely moving in that direction, isn't it?
It is, and actually this election is, it probably is. I mean, they've said this about many other elections, but I think this election is the turning point. We're either going to continue proceeding down this road, and we will lose this country, or we're going to hang on to this country for dear life, and this form of government, and the powerful sovereignty of its citizens, we have to hold on to this country for dear life because there's so many adversarial, powerful people that want us gone. They just want us gone.
Oh, sure. And really, even after this election, I mean, the fight is never going to be over. I mean, we're going to have to continually battle.
You're right.
Yeah.
That old expression, freedom isn't free.
No.
Are you there?
Yes.
Oh. You're absolutely right. The election, if we get the change we need to hold on tight to this country, it's like when the engineer puts the brake on the train, it doesn't just suddenly stop. There's forward momentum. There's a lot we're going to have to work through and work hard to hold on to over the coming years. And I guess that's where I wish more citizens that live here and that benefit from this beautiful country, I wish they had a deeper appreciation for what it would be like to live somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think, Elaine? What can people do? I mean, the people that are affected, obviously, that you know, live in areas where the tribes are trying to overreach on their water rights and on their property and all that. But like the guys up in Klamath, I guess, I was thinking about that before the break. There's an administrative law decision up there that gave the tribe, the Klamath tribe, time immemorial water rights.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa.
Well, time immemorial and aboriginal rights they're myths. They're fictions. There are a couple of little outlier cases with a couple of Pueblo tribes in the Southwest who were initially under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. There's a couple of little outlier cases that have provided tribes with aboriginal rights to some land. But you have to look at it this way. The entire North American and South American continent was aboriginal. Absolutely aboriginal. The ancestral lands of all of these tribes was the entire North American continent and South American continent. You know, the game changed in 1789 when the United States government was formed. So this time immemorial stuff and aboriginal stuff is pre-constitutional. And you're hearing all kinds of talk these days about, wow, we precede the federal government. We precede the United States. We have time immemorial rights. We have aboriginal ancestral lands. Well, no, you don't. Not since 1789. Anything pre-constitutional or extra-constitutional is unconstitutional. That's what I mean about holding on to this government, holding on to this country. Because the movement, the ancestral rights, the aboriginal rights, the time immemorial, that's all coming from the United Nations, promoting these tribes to sing that song as loud as they can to the elected officials that they fund. And the current administration is putting jurisdictional legs under that stuff. The adversary is our executive branch. Our federal government is the adversary here. And that's a very harsh thing to say, but it is. It's not to break down this country. It's the people that we elect to serve us that are handing it over. And as citizens, we have to really be inquisitive with those we elect, those who are running for office. Where do you stand on this? How seriously do you believe and will you uphold the Constitution? What is your position on federal Indian policy? This is the best kept secret that nobody wants to talk about. It's too big, too good a deal for the ones that are benefiting from it, but it's costing the taxpayers and American citizens our country. It really is.
Oh, and it's, I know everybody's heard it time and time again, but this also exemplifies how important it is, this election as far as our Supreme Court goes, because the Supreme Court's the only one standing between us and Armageddon now.
Thank you for mentioning that, because that's on the line. If we get any more liberal justices on the bench, Justice Thomas will be a lonely voice, and we're done.
And where do you think he wants to go with this?
You know, I think a lot of us have tried to figure out solutions. I don't know what solutions are. I really do cherish our American history, which is absolutely incorporated with American Indian history. And I have an affection for the noble Indian warriors, even old Geronimo. I just have a deep affection and respect for American Indian history and culture and traditions. And I do so deeply want to see those preserved by the Indian families because they want to, not because they're paid to.
Do you think the Indian heritage and history is being rewritten to the extent that our American history is being rewritten?
Well, it's not only being rewritten, it's being entirely reversed. Absolutely reversed. I mean, the folks that settled Jamestown, and it took 40 years, so they did not come here as conquerors. They came here as pilgrims escaping a tyranny in Europe, and they came here for religious freedom. They didn't come here to wipe out the Indians. As a matter of fact, the Jamestown Massacre wiped out most of Jamestown. But you don't read about that. All of the skirmishes between tribes amongst each other, they were warring with each other constantly, and they still would be if it weren't for the treaties, or if it weren't for this whole system that says, hey, everybody, let's hang together and we'll all get this stuff. You know, when they're not mutually on the same goal, they fight amongst themselves. Tribes fight amongst each other quite seriously. So, you know, the answer, I like to look at the Amish. The Amish is a religious, it's a culture, it's a lifestyle, and it is one that has continued and preserved itself beautifully in the United States, in compliance with the Constitution, but they live and practice their daily culture and traditions the way they choose to, and nobody pays them to. You know, they're not going to the feds or the state saying, hey, we want to continue our Amish traditions. Well, any culture that wants to revere itself will. And those that don't, won't. It's that simple.
True.
It shouldn't require something equivalent to the defense budget for a culture to preserve itself.
Yeah, that's true.
They either do or they don't.
And the Amish is a really example. We've got about 10 minutes left. We've got to take one quick break, and then we will come back and finish up the top of the hour with our friend Elaine Willman. We're chatting about federal Indian policy. She's got a couple of great books. Slumbering Thunder is her most recent one, and you can find that on our website, wethepeopleradio.us.
They took the whole Cherokee Nation, put us on this reservation, took away our ways of life. The tomahawk and the bowie knife took away our native tongue and taught their English to our young.
That poor old woman.
There you go, Elaine. You got your favorite song in.
Get it. You get it. Well, it's a good thing we're not on Skype. when that bumper music comes on, I love Collider. It's my first awareness of listening to a radio station as a little girl. It was KREM in Spokane Valley. And Collider would come on, and I'd just start bawling. I just felt so sorry for that moment. I think I was 9 or 10 years old. I just couldn't stand it before old Collider. So, if I were on Skype, you'd see me up and dancing around on the bumper music. You know?
Another good reason.
I sort of have a childlike faith. You know, I really, really do. This is such a distressing and uncomfortable subject that I have been zoned in on for 25 years, but I have a fundamental spirit that somehow we will be all right, all is well, and things will come out okay. And when you look back at our country, I mean, look what all this country's been through just to become 227 years old.
Yeah.
And look what we've gone through on a day, you know, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We've just come through hell as a country. And I'm just kind of thinking somehow we will muddle through this. You know, somehow we will. We have to. So that's that little blind faith that...
Well, it's almost like a bad experiment we've gone through, and it's time to clear off the table and get back to what we truly believe. And you know, get things right
exactly.
again.
Yep.
Do you catch a lot of grief from the Indian community, from your books and speaking out?
You know, amazingly, I catch almost no disagreement or flack from tribal members. Or as I said, I've lived, 16 years on the Yakima Reservation, 8 years on the Oneida in Wisconsin, and I've been out here on the Flathead for over a year. I have very good tribal friends, and they just tell me stuff, and they can't speak up for themselves. So I get very little disagreement or flack from tribal members themselves. Where I do take the heat is what I call the Indian industry, you know, the lobbyists and
the
legal
government.
Council, the radicals that are just, you know, the elite industry, Indian industry itself. Just calls me terrible names. I mean, they call me racist, KKK, Nazi, bigot. They call me all kinds of things. And I say, you know, have at it. You know, I honor my Indian ancestry. I so could worry about the quality of life of tribal families across the country. You know, my grandchildren are biracial. You know, most of our families are very diverse. Most of our American families are multicultural. And I think that's a good thing. Good thing. But these guys, you know, when I speak up about what's wrong with federal Indian policy, and I apparently am one of very few that do, they come after me. You can Google my name and you'll find all kinds of, you'll find some good stuff, but you'll find some crap too. But it's not coming from tribal families and tribal people. It's coming from these lobbyists and writers and the radicals that are pushing for more, more, more. Those folks don't have an America. They don't have a native language term for thank you or enough. I mean, we owe them forever, and it's just foolish. It's just foolish. So
yeah,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it doesn't endear them to the rest of the people out there. Ooh, we have 30 seconds left. It actually isn't helping. I mean, it's a little bit like all of these divides that are being created. I'm more special than you. And so if you're in the not special category, you owe me, you owe me, you owe me.
Yes.
And what's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine.
Well, once we got into the business of reparations, you know, everybody came forward. So, Elaine, thank you very much for coming on with us today. It's been very enlightening.
I hope everybody will go on there and read the articles. They're excellent. And your latest in The New American was fabulous. If you don't have time for the whole book, read the article at least and listen to some of the interviews. I've posted all three of our previous shows on there. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be back next week with something fun. Thanks a million zillion, Elaine.
God bless you guys for having the courage to do these broadcasts on difficult subjects. I really value the courage that you guys display when you do these things. So thank you very, very much.
Thanks a bunch. We're just hiding behind and goofing around. Thanks, Elaine. Thanks, Bob. Bye. See you next week.
Okay.
Thanks,
Take
Elaine.
Care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Bill.
Bye, John Boy.
Penny rang his wife and family to say he loved them so. Then he told the other passengers, let's roll. Let's roll, America. There's a job to be done. Let's roll, America. There's a battle to be won. Wake up, America. You're too young to die. Let's roll.